This is the lecture tape for February 23rd, 1999, and we're on the legal system in Deuteronomies chapter 20 through 23. Today's lesson is on war, adultery, rape, and rebellious children, and I really wasn't too excited about this section when I began it. But as I studied it more and more, I discovered God's ways are not only righteous, but humane and caring. God's plan was that man would never have to deal with these issues. But because of free will and the nature of man to rebel against God's laws, he sets down the way in which each of these areas are to be handled. You'll also notice that the laws given today are more details of the Ten Commandments. Today's lesson actually deals with Commandment 6, to honor your parents, 7, do not commit murder, and 8, do not commit adultery. Well, Moses continues on with his second message in what's our chapter 20, taking up the issue of warfare. Israel is entering the promised land not only to possess it, but to carry out God's judgment against the Canaanites. We've already learned that these conquering battles are holy wars. That's wars that are initiated and directed by God, and it's a judgment against the evil practices of the Canaanites. But because of the very geographical location that Israel will have in the land of Canaan, they're going to be constantly warring. Because if you are traveling from Egypt in the south to Babylon and Assyria in the north, everybody is going to have to go through the land of Canaan. And so Israel will be forever fighting to protect its own safety and security. So even though every battle is going to be a little different, there's going to be one fact that's always the same. Israel will always be outnumbered. So chapter 20 begins with the greatest enemy. Fear. Fear in the military will do more damage than any external enemy. And to address this, 20 verse 2 says, when you are about to go into battle, the priest shall come forward and address the army. This is God's war. And so the priests are to begin the process, and they're to do so by giving the army encouragement. The soldiers are told in verse 3, hear, O Israel, today you are going into battle against your enemies. Do not be faint-hearted or afraid. Do not be terrified or give way to panic before them. The priests were to help them to focus away from the fear onto God. They'd already told them in verse 1 that the Lord their God would be with them, the God who brought them out of Egypt. They were to remind them of their past history. Here you are, fresh out of slavery, no weapons, no training, and this powerful, high-tech Egyptian army's coming against you. They've got horses, they've got chariots, they've got full armor. And you got to a place where the Red Sea was in front of you and the army was behind you, and it looked like you had no place to go. Remember, Israel, God parted that sea, you went through safely, and then God destroyed the entire army and you did nothing. That very same God, the God of the past now, is going with you right now. Look at verse 4. For the Lord your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies and to give you victory. You have no need to fear, Israel, because that very same God is the one going with you. He will fight for you again, and he will give you the victory. Well, after the priest then finishing this pep talk and encouraging the army, then the officers are to come forward and thin out the ranks. With God fighting for them, it's important then that every man with them has his hearts fully turned towards God and towards the battle at hand. And so a list of 3 military exemptions are given. The first one is if he's built a house but not dedicated it. A home was considered a gift from the Lord, and the first thing that they were to do upon entering that home was give it back to the Lord, to dedicate it. And God says if he has this house built, but he hasn't had a chance to move in and dedicate it, and he goes to war and dies, then somebody else will move in and dedicate it, and his family could be without a home. Secondly, he says a newly planted vineyard, but hasn't produced its fruit yet, is another exemption. We learned from our lessons in Numbers that it takes 5 years for a tree or a vineyard to produce fruit. The first 3 years, it's not mature enough, And the fourth year, when it does produce a crop, it belongs to the Lord. So we're talking about 5 years from planting a new vineyard. This is not an existing one, but it's the first time. God says the man has put a lot of hard work into this, and his family should be able to receive the benefit for that. If he goes to war before the first crop comes in, then somebody else will get the benefit from it. Somebody else will eat the fruit, and his family could be left destitute or in debt. And the third one was one who is engaged but not yet married. And we're going to learn next week when we get to chapter 25 that it includes the first year. God is concerned about establishing a good, strong family. And he says a man needs to be married, and he needs to be married for a year. And it's assumed during that year that he will produce an heir so that someone will be able to carry on his name and it won't be wiped out from the nation of Israel if he should die in battle. Well, after all the exemptions are given, the officer is then to send home any men who are afraid or faint-hearted. Now, we have to remember that Israel is not a warfaring people. When they get into the Promised Land, they're going to be farmers and ranchers. They're going to have herds, flocks, and fields, but they are not going to be trained warriors. Fear will be a natural reaction, but that's not what he's talking about. He's saying if a person gets to the point where they literally freeze and they can't fight in one of those critical situations, he won't only be a danger to himself, but to all those around him. Consequently, it would be a terrible morale problem to realize, I have to fight next to this guy and he freezes. You know, who's going to cover me? So God says that person is to be released and sent home. There's also a greater underlying problem with that, because it means that person doesn't have faith in God, because he's already commanded them to be strong and courageous because he would fight for them. So this person is not only afraid, but they lack faith in God. Once the army is assembled, then God's strategy shows concern for both the present and future generations as they go to battle. Look at verse 10. When you march up to attack a city, make its people an offer of peace. When Israel comes to the outlying cities, they aren't just supposed to go in and wipe it all out. They're supposed to offer peace first. Then if the people say no, they can go in and kill the men, but the women, children, and animals can be taken as plunder. If they agree to peace, then the whole community, including the men, are taken into forced labor. But as we know from before, that does not apply to the seven nations in Canaan, which is Israel's inheritance. They have to be utterly destroyed because God said their evil practices would lead Israel astray. He continues on, though, in verse 19. He says, "Do not destroy its trees by putting an axe to them, because you can eat their fruit. Do not cut them down. Are trees of the field people that they should besiege them?" What's he saying? He's saying, just because you want to besiege a city, don't destroy the fruit trees. He says, if you need lumber, then go ahead and choose the other trees. But save that, because it's going to be a long process. You'll need food to eat, and future generations will need food to eat. So leave the trees. There's a real important contrast here between God's laws and the military practices of those around them. This was a common practice of the Egyptians, Assyrians, and Babylonians. An Egyptian soldier wrote this, "I took away their very source of life, for I cut down their grain. I felled all their groves and all their pleasant trees. I destroyed it all." This report goes on and says with pride that they ravaged the territory and it became a land upon which there were no trees. God says this is totally unacceptable. Trees are not people. Don't take away the ability to create livelihood afterwards. Well, God has expressed his concern for families regarding leaving them for war. Now in chapter 21, he deals with a number of situations that might arise in a community. Each would have a strong effect upon families. And the Lord wants his people to know how they are to deal with each one of these situations. The first one concerns finding a body murdered, lying in a field. All the laws previously have assumed that the murder and the murderer were known and that there actually were witnesses. But what happens if you come on a field and find a dead body? The entire community will be affected. Not so much that a violent criminal's on the loose, but because the land has been defiled by the shedding of blood. Well, God says that the nearest town then must take full responsibility for the cleansing of the people and the land. The elders of that town are to perform the purification ceremony. It's presumed that the murder victim probably came from the nearest town, so that's why they did that. But if he was from a long distance, the nearest town still had to take responsibility. Atonement was required by a young heifer, one that had never had a calf, so essentially a virgin heifer, and they were to be taken and killed ceremoniously in an unsown field, a virgin field, and it was to be done by fresh water that was running. All of these were a sign of newness, a fresh start, if you will. Now, since there was no murderer present, the heifer could only ceremonially cover the murder. Therefore, there would be no blood shed upon the ground. And if you think about that, only the priest could offer up blood as an atonement, and then only at the altar at the central sanctuary that God set up, which we know is going to be Jerusalem. So in this case, we see that there are Levites present. They would be the local Levites, but they are there only to make sure that the ceremony is performed properly. But it's the elders of the town that are actually doing the ceremony. It begins by washing their hands over the slain heifer. And the heifer, as you saw, had a neck broken, but not slashed. Look at verse 7. And they are to declare, "Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it done. Do not hold your people guilty of the blood of an innocent man. Accept this atonement for your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Lord, and do not hold your people guilty of the blood of an innocent man." What are they doing? They're symbolically washing their hands of the murder of this man. They're saying, "We didn't do it." Interesting, because when you think about the death of Jesus, Pilate, in the presence of the people, washes his hands and said, "I am innocent of the blood of this man." And we even use that phrase today, "I wash my hands of these situation." This is where it comes from. It's a declaration of innocence in the presence of the Lord. Having done this, then look at verse 9. "Then the bloodshed will be atoned for, and you will purge from yourself the guilty of shedding innocent blood, since you have done what is right in the eyes of the Lord." So that would then allow the community to worship the Lord again, and that the land would be considered clean once again. Well, war leads to captives, so the next laws deals with women who have been captured during war. She's a human being, and she's to be treated humanely. It mentions that she's beautiful, and that would mean that the captor desired her. And God says, if you want her, I don't want you to do as the pagans do, which humiliates and degrades her by raping her, but you may marry her. After showing proper respect, she was to be given shelter and security by taking her into his home. She was to be given decent clothing, because she was to put aside what she had been wearing when she was taken captive. And she was to be given time to grieve, to mourn her father and mother. 30 days was the grieving period as set down under the law. God says, then after the 30 days, if you still wish to marry her, you may do so. And then she receives full rights as an Israelite's wife. Prior to the wedding, however, she was to shave her head and trim her nails. This was an indication of putting aside all paganisms and taking on the religion as well as the nationality of Israel. The law further protects her, because if after the husband marries her, he decides that they're just not compatible, as we would say, a pagan and an Israelite, he is not free to turn her back into a slave or sell her. He may only release her so that she may start a new life. Well, having mentioned wives, the next logical step is children, because wives result in children. So the law deals with the firstborn son. God says that the firstborn is to receive the greater portion of the inheritance, and a father may not take it away from him and give it to another more favored son simply because he does not like his mother anymore. God says, the firstborn belongs to me, and it is his right by law that he receive the inheritance. God's laws for the family work only then if the parents teach the laws and the children obey it. And God says there will become times when children will rebel. So how do you deal with a stubborn and rebellious son? He says if he refuses to obey his mother and father despite attempts to discipline him, then the matter is to be referred to the elders of the city. The parents are to take him there, and the elders then will decide what needs to be done. And if the death penalty is to be carried out, it is the elders and not the parents who are the ones that do this. Now, this seems very, very harsh to us, but God has four reasons for doing this. First, his stubbornness is really a defiance or rebellion against God, because God's commandment said that a child is to honor his parents. Secondly, he's to be held accountable. Life is a responsibility as well as a privilege. Nobody is free to damage himself, his parents, others, or the society without being disciplined. Thirdly, parents are to be supported. When parents are trying to raise their children according as to how God directed them, then the elders of the city are to support the parents. However, as you saw, the parents were not the ones to punish him with his own hands. They needed somebody far more objective, which would be the elders of the town. And fourth, to protect the community. If he's allowed to continue in this rebellion, it won't be long before others will join him. It's just the very nature of sin. Now, before we leave this, I just want to let you know that there's absolutely no evidence recorded anywhere in the Old Testament that this law actually was carried out, that any child was ever stoned to death for rebellion. It was used simply as a warning about what could happen. Well, the next few chapters give the details of the seventh and eighth commandments, which are not committing murder or adultery, and reminds Israel of God's generosity and his love. And because he is this way, he expects his people to live that way also, particularly with regard to one another. It begins with a way of executing a criminal. When an execution takes place in Israel, the people are warned not to cause any further pain. The body is not to remain hung on a tree after dark, but must be buried by the end of the day, because a person hung on a tree is under God's curse. Now, we already know Israel does not hang its offenders on crosses to die. That actually doesn't even come in until the time of the Romans, much, much later. But what they were in a habit of doing is, after a person was stoned to death, they were actually impaled and displayed around a city, whether it was enemy or within Israel, to be an example to others. But it was considered the highest form of humility, because a man hanging on a tree was abandoned by God and man. So he's basically hanging there with no identity at all. Next is lost and found property. It deals with both animals and clothing. When something was found that was not yours, you were expected to take care of it until the rightful owner came along. If you saw an animal in trouble, God says you must go to its aid. You cannot ignore it, even if it's inconvenient or costly to you, because at some time it may be you that is missing an animal. God says the animal needs your help and your brother deserves it. One of the Bibles has a little commentary note. It says, this does not lead to finders, keepers, losers, weepers, which is what we all grew up with as children. Chapter 23:5 brings about improper clothing. It says, a woman must not wear men's clothing, nor a man wear women's clothing, for the Lord your God detests anyone that does this. When I grew up in the 50s, this was a verse used against women wearing pants, and I can still see my mother in a freshly ironed dress, hose, and 3-inch heels cleaning the house. But I want you to see it in context. It deals with a sexual promiscuity that was part of the Canaanite pagan rites. Men and women who wanted to have children were required to exchange their undergarments, and then some magical ceremonies occurred. Cross-dressing and transvestites, along with degrading sex and homosexuality practices, were all part of the Canaanite worship. This law simply says, my people, do not do as the pagans do. God has designed the sexes to be different, and they are to remain in their roles. As far as clothing, it doesn't really relate to that because both men and women in the Israelite community at this time wore tunics. The only difference was a woman wore a head covering. So it had to do with the pagan practices. God said, I designed a man to be a man and a woman to be a woman, and that's the way they are to remain. Next, we go on to the protection of animals. The earth and everything belongs to it, and that includes the animals. Protecting others. Homes, if you can think to the pictures that you've seen, they were created with flat roofs, and it wasn't too long before they became additional roofs. And so stairways were put up on the outside to bring an access, and they would use that, particularly the women, for drying and for grains and all sorts of things. And children would go up there, and it would be very easily for them to fall off. So God says you need to put a railing around there to prevent any serious accidents or deaths. So we see God's building regulations way back then. Well, moving then from the laws on murder to adultery, Moses gives laws of mixing things together or adulterating. Two of them have to do with work and then two with clothing. They are not to permitted to sow different kinds of seeds together, nor yoke dissimilar animals together. They were also not allowed to wear a garment woven of two different fibers, but they were required to sew tassels on the corners of their clothing. Now, each of these laws were important at the time they were given, but we don't fully understand why they were given. The best thought is that Israelite was supposed to be different from their neighbors. Some references that deal with this is in Egypt, they mixed vegetables with the grapes in their vineyards, and clothing were woven with mixed fibers to be used in occult practices. So it may be God's way of saying, I don't want you to do this. I want you to obey me, not carry on any practices you learned in Egypt. Or maybe it's because the high priest's garments were also woven with wool and linen, and that was considered a sacred garment, so maybe they weren't to be allowed to use that for everyday clothing. As far as yoking animals together, there's a very sound reason for that. A weak animal like a donkey could not be yoked with a heavy, strong animal like an ox for very long without doing physical damage to both of the animals. The ox would want to plow heavy and long distance, while a donkey would be physically unable to do that. It's just a way of protecting the animals. He also says they were not to be muzzled while they were plowing. Simply, you take care of your animals. They are to be fed because they are serving you. The tying of the tassels was covered in great detail in Numbers chapter 15. They were to wear tassels on their clothing to remind them of God's laws. The tassels on the end were to have four knots in them, each knot representing one of the letters of Yahweh's name, W-H-Y-H, and then the five spaces in between them were to remind them of the five books of Moses, including the laws that they were to keep. Well, we move next to adultery in marriage. God's purpose is that physical sexual relationships are to be confined to marriage and to marriage alone. The first law deals with a husband who goes to claim his bride and finds out that he has been deceived concerning her virginity at the time of the wedding. Now, virginity was of extreme importance because it assured the man that the wife had not had relations with another man. Therefore, the child that resulted was indeed his. On the other hand, it was extremely serious if he accused her of adultery and it was not true. So either the husband has to be exposed for defaming his wife, or she has to be exposed for premarital sex. The evidence that was used to clear her name is the wedding cloth, or the bed sheets, if you will, that apparently was kept by her mother. We saw the video on the Hebrew wedding during our Christmas luncheon, and that indicated that when the bride and groom consummated the marriage, it was at their new home. The entire bridal party and the guests, including the parents of both the bride and the groom, stood outside until the marriage was consummated. At that point, the best man would be standing in the door and the groom would call out, "We're married," and then the celebration would begin. It appears that the parents of the bride then kept that cloth as evidence should they need it later. If they find out that she was indeed a virgin, Her husband then has defamed her, and he had to pay 100 shekels, which is twice the bride price which he had already paid, to her father for slander, and he was forbidden from ever divorcing her. But if the cloth could not be produced, then she was taken to her father's home and there stoned to death because she had committed adultery, apparently while she was still living in her father's home. That's interesting also because it defiles the father's land then, and he would have to make atonement for that. The second law is an uncompromising condemnation of adultery. Adultery required breaking of three commandments: coveting, stealing, and adultery, and both the male and the female were to be put to death. The third and fourth laws then deal with the rape of a virgin, one who is pledged in marriage. If it occurred in the town, both she and the man were guilty and were stoned to death, and she was believed guilty because if she had been in town and cried out, someone would have come to her aid. On the other hand, if it occurred out in the country, she was considered innocent and only the man was killed because if she'd have cried out, nobody would have heard her. The fifth law then deals with a seduction of a virgin who is not pledged in marriage. The offender then must make financial compensation to the family, which was 50 shekels, that's the bride price, marry the girl, and never be able to divorce her. He had to care for her all the rest of her life. And the last one included incest between a man and his stepmother. It was strictly forbidden, and both were punished by death. All of these laws then were specifically designed to preserve marriages and maintain the well-being of the family. Well, sexual impurity leads to the next laws regarding certain people who were not permitted to enter the assembly of God. It mentions a man physically mutilated, and this probably refers to castration. This was done as part of the Canaanite religion. It also mentions a bastard or a child of a forbidden marriage. This generally refers to a child of a temple prostitute, and at birth that child would have been dedicated to the pagan god. So they were not to be combined then, the pagan worship, with the worship of the one true God. A child also may refer to a child of incest. But these two laws are just evidence of physical and moral damage from practicing the pagan religions and how it affected others. The restrictions given here were to preserve Israel's distinction. We next come to the Ammonites and Moabites. Both were forbidden to enter into the congregation. The Ammonites because of what they did not do, and the Moabites for what they did do. Now the Ammonites did not show compassion to the Israelites during their wilderness journey. And the Moabites then attempted to thwart Israel and actually come against them in battle and win by enlisting Balaam, the prophet that was supposed to curse Israel but wasn't successful, and then they ended up using their women to seduce the Israelite men into Baal worship. It says they were not allowed into the 10th generation. I did some research on this, and the 10th generation means essentially forever. No Ammonites and Moabites were allowed into the assembly. But we'll find as we go along that that law was actually changed. In fact, we're going to find a Moabitess in the lineage of Jesus Christ. But at this point, they are forbidden from entering into the assembly. Both the Edomites and the Egyptians were not to be rejected. The Edomites were regarded as brothers, and the Egyptians not as their slave masters, but as the nation that took Jacob and his family in during a serious famine and allowed them to live in the land. It's the kindness of those days that were not to be forgotten. If you think about it, the judgment upon those that enslaved the Israelites took place immediately because God took the firstborn of every single family as payment for that sin. It says that these children to the third generation are not permitted in, but after that they are permitted into the assembly of the Lord. It was believed then by the third generation they would know whether or not they were true believers in Yahweh. It's interesting because when they're talking about this, it's not that they can't participate in the life of Israel, it's that they do not have a say or essentially voting rights. in the assembly. Well, as I reflected on today's lessons, I saw God saying to Israel that even though war will be necessary in the future, they are to be humane and caring, not like their pagan neighbors. When I thought about the exemptions for a new house, a newly planted field, and a new marriage, as well as just being afraid, I tried to imagine one of the Egyptian soldiers saying that to his leader, or even the Americans during the draft, and then being given an opportunity to go home because it had seriously inconvenienced them or they were afraid. Even in war, God's ways are different from man's ways. It was also good, especially with today's society, to be reminded of God's view on adultery, rape, and rebellious children. God has some very specific things to say about each, and I'm sure you picked up on that in your groups today, but the underlying principle here is the importance of the family. The family was designed by God, and as such, it's to be protected in every way possible. The ideal is the family is as God designed it, but God also knew that that would not always be the case. In fact, next week's lesson deals more with the divorce and widows and how the family is to be taken care of. But for us today, it's another reminder that we need to honor and protect those important relationships in our lives, our husbands, our children, even our parents. It also shows the importance of a community coming together to support one another. Even though we're no longer bound by the Old Testament laws, we would do well to follow God's principles because He said they were designed for our own good, so things would go well with us. It's certainly something to think about.